Radio City, John Grayson, Rob Ross with you once again, doing some talking about what's going on this week in our heads and in pop culture. And of course, we'll get to the segment in our heads at the end of this here very broadcast. But thank you once again for listening to us go through our thing. And Rob, how's everything going with you?
So far, so good, John. How are you doing this week?
Not bad. It's, boy, is it the dog days of summer. You were talking, before we got together for the show, about how gorgeous the weather is in New York. Boy, for the last couple of days in St. Louis, it's been broiling.
You know, it's that comfortable warm. It's not that horrible humidity, that discomforting kind of oppressive heat that the minute you step outside the door, you go, I think I'm going to stay in if there's nothing I need to do.
Right.
I mean, had those days here and there, but this last week, by and large, has just been very nice and very comfortable. You know, dry, obviously seasonably warm, but dry air, nothing oppressive. And for that, I'm thankful. I mean, this morning's trek to the grocery store, absolutely delightful. Having the windows open on the expressway, it's terrific.
Good deal. Yeah, it's been bad here, but then again, you know, it comes and goes. So the humidity is a little bit lower today than it has been. Maybe we'll go out and take a walk a little bit later on. But musically, there's so much going on right now. And I know there's one that you've been looking forward to and one that you're involved in that we're going to talk about a little bit. But let's kick off with what's going on for fans of Chris Bell.
Well, as we once previewed, the first of the compilations has officially been released by Omnivore this past Friday. Looking Forward, which is the pre-big star work of Chris Bell. It's a 22-track compilation, I should say. It's this wonderful compendium of songs that Chris did with the two bands, even though it's really the same aggregate of players, albeit a couple of shuffles of the lineup here and there, prior to Big Star, the bands that Big Star were born out of, and that's Ice Water and Rock City. But you also have the first thing that Chris was thought to have recorded a piece, which has been heard on other compilations. And I should say that a good portion of the CD has previously released material. It's just that it's nice to have it in one place at one time. A track called Psychedelic Stuff, which has a different mix than the other previous releases, where you can hear his vocals far more up front and it's a lot cleaner and crisper. That's the most important thing about this compilation. Everything's been remixed and it's just such high quality that you hear little nuances that you may not have picked up on before if you know these songs and have them or have heard them. And the tracks from Ice Water and Rock City are just absolutely outstanding. There are some tracks that fans of Big Star will know because these are, for all intents and purposes, the first passes at these songs before they became quote-unquote Big Star standards. So all in all, this is a great jumping-off point, especially if you're not familiar with the work of Chris Bell or you only know of him through Big Star and or I Am the Cosmos and don't realize that he had a very rich musical life prior to the formation of Big Star. This is definitely a great way to also, as I've said about the best of Big Star, way to introduce somebody of the younger generation and give them a good explanation and education at the same time. It's also just a great piece to have in your collection if you're like me, a completist. But again, this is the first, because coming later in the summer will be an official biography on Chris Bell and a 6 LP set, which has everything that Chris Bell ever recorded. And the sixth side of this vinyl record has the only known recorded interview with Chris Bell. And then there will be another release of an extended, further than it was before, version of I Am the Cosmos. This is coming through Omnivore. And as usual, they do an outstanding job.
That's great. And you talked about the fact that if people are not familiar that much with the work of Chris Bell before Big Star, it's interesting because with Alex Chilton, of course, we've got the Box Tops and several other things that he did that got pop radio airplay. So if you listen to this, do you get the other side of those building blocks? Like if you already know what Alex Chilton did, you listen to Chris Bell's earlier stuff, does it make Big Star make more sense?
Absolutely, without question. In fact, the neat thing about this record is it clearly shows you where he was going to go as he was getting there. I mean, those tracks that became Big Star tracks, they're literally the finished versions, albeit a couple of little touches here and there, a different vocal version, you know?
Yeah.
A perfect example, the track Feel, which is not on this particular release, but there was a version of Feel that came out on the Rock City album that doesn't have the exact same vocal tracks. It's a slightly different delivery. Mm-hmm. If I was going to say one thing about the Big Star versions, they're a little bit more fully realized and a bit more ballsy. You know, they're sung with so much more confidence. But you can absolutely see, not only from these tracks where Chris Bell was going to go with the music, but I Am the Cosmos, it's been often said and thought, and I do tend to agree that, as it was very wisely put, oh, so that's where Big Star went. You know, all the pristine beauty, and I'm paraphrasing here from the very wonderful Rick Clark, who said this in the movie. You know, I Am the Cosmos went from the pristine beauty of Radio City, even though Chris Bell is not a part of Radio City, and puts it right here with I Am the Cosmos. And the songs that make up most of the I Am the Cosmos clearly have a consistency about it. You know, the one thing about certainly Radio City and Big Star Third is that they're kind of, because they're all Alex Chilton controlled productions and songs, they're a lot more all over the place. Radio City is far more consistent than Third. I mean, there's, you know, they're like night and day.
Yeah.
You know, you have number one record, which is the original four piece. You have the balance of Chilton and Bell. But then you have Radio City, which is pretty much all Chilton. However, Chris Bell definitely was part of the group when they had originally written and rehearsed Oh My Soul and Back of a Car. There's no question about it.
Yeah.
But still, tracks like Maud Lang and She's a Mover, that's not even technically Big Star, you know, even though those are credited to the band. And Third, as we all know, is just an exercise in controlled insanity. But I Am the Cosmos, even though that was patched together from unreleased tracks, has a consistency about it because Chris Bell managed to bridge his rock leanings with his acoustic style. And it works perfectly. And when that comes out again, if you don't already have this record, it'll certainly give you an ideal glimpse of how even-keeled Chris Bell was as a performer. That's the most important thing, is I think he was the balance of consistency in Big Star. And, of course, I like to speculate, of the songs that came out later on I Am the Cosmos, which ones would have, in fact, been part of Big Star Records had they stayed together or had he gone back to the band. So, but it's going to be a well worthwhile summer to look forward to these.
Excellent. And of course, the first one, as we said, is already out from Omnivore. And Omnivore also responsible for sliding a little more new music across your desk this week as well. And you ran across a guy by the name of Chris Price. Where did he come from?
Chris Price's name I glimpsed a couple of times, but it hadn't registered initially. He actually is the man responsible directly for bringing to life Emmett Rhodes' return album, Rainbow Ends,
okay.
Last year. Or should it? Was it 2014, 2015, 2016? Yes. Time's flying right by me, so I apologize for not remembering the specific date. But I know I say this a lot, but he has a wonderful sensibility about him that is a combination of Todd Rundgren. He's got the McCartney kind of vibe about him, especially in the construction of the songs, because he tends to use those neat little McCartney-like devices where he kind of builds into a completely almost different song in the middle and then comes back again,
right,
connecting it almost seamlessly. But he also has a very Harry Nilsson kind of feel about him. I let you slip away with time.
Hey!
So it's that wonderful trifecta of my early 70s pop childhood coming back again. In a very modern way. He's very natural. It's a very organic sound that he has. It's pop, but it's thoughtful pop. It's right. Not cutesy.
Yeah, and in the song that you have linked on the page with your review, Man Down, first of all, it's a great tune. And second of all, a couple of things struck me. First of all, is his voice on that track. He doesn't blow you away with his vocal style, but it, boy, does it fit the song really well. And the other thing about it is the way that it's produced, the way the guitars are utilized. You mentioned your early 70s pop leanings. I was thinking, you know, this song would have fit perfectly had it been out at the time on the soundtrack for Slapshot. It's that same kind of feel with a lot of the songs that are on that soundtrack to begin with, without the disco stuff, obviously, but it reminded me of the pop radio of that era a lot. And, you know, it was almost seemingly like a deliberate thing where he thought, you know, let me see if I can write a 1975 pop hit.
And the thing is if you listen to the album all the way through, most of the songs do have that kind of feel. It's almost like an FM radio from around 1974-75.
Yep.
You're absolutely correct. I mean, I would think Man Down would fit right after on the Slapshot soundtrack, a little bit south of West Saskatoon.
Was it south Saskatoon? Yes.
How do you forget that, you know? But really, it's such a great... You have to be gifted, that's my opinion, to be able to approximate these sounds, because songs in the 70s really took on, and you know, I know people give it a bad rap or they laugh about it, you know, one-hit wonders and, you know, the me decade and all that, but 70s songwriters, those who were well-known and had track records, like McCartney and Nilsson and Rundgren, but others, people who wrote the songs that became big hits, who we don't know for sure who the authors of the songs are, you had to have a certain amount of talent and skill to be able to execute such well-constructed songs that last a lifetime.
Yep.
And the beauty of this record is he has that ability. And it certainly doesn't hurt the fact that he's aligned with someone like Emmett Rhodes, who is truly a one-man band.
Yeah, so it definitely one to check out. And it, as you said, it's just a lot of fun to listen to. So check out Chris Price and listen closely to the lyrics, because there's a lot going on there. As you said, it's a very thoughtful kind of piece. So the brand new album is called Stop Talking, and it's out from Chris Price. And we've been talking for the last few weeks. We keep mentioning it to each other. You know, we've got to talk about the Co-op Communique, because we've led into it a couple of times and never went deep into what's there. And let's, for folks who are not familiar with the project yet, let's talk first of all about what the Co-op Communique is.
It is a project of independent, it's a compilation that you can download. It is from a direct website called the Co-op Communique. It is the brainchild and gift, if you will, certainly for those of us who have contributed to it, of our own D.W. Dunphy. And it is a compendium of songs by independent musicians who, without this, I don't think any of us would really have an outlet. Some do, and that's great, but a lot of us wouldn't. And so he's given us a place to air what we've created. And I have been very, very fortunate, and I say that in very large letters, to be part of the last two releases. Mm-hmm. Co-op Communique number 2 had the unreleased second single from The Punchline. That was my contribution, which was Well of Loneliness. It was written and recorded. It was written in the summer of 1989 and recorded in the fall of 1991 at the Institute of Audio Research in Manhattan, where we were sort of the guinea pig house band. You know, when students there would learn how to actually use the equipment and record, we were there to provide the music, since our drummer was an instructor and an actual administrator there at the time. So it was a perfect setup, you know, free recording time for us.
Yeah.
We recorded the single because the flip side was going to actually be our version of the Bongos, the Bulrushes, which also has yet to see the light of day. Unfortunately, we never got a chance to go back and finish either song per se. We never got to mix it down and add maybe a few little embellishments here and there. But taken as it is and was in the version that I came away with, and unfortunately those tapes will never be seen or heard again, because I am sure they've either been long destroyed or erased or recorded over, certainly. And that includes what would have been the original version of The Punchlines to get to the other side. But Well of Loneliness stands on its own as a good track, and I always wanted people to hear it because it was such a good song. And it was also a collaborative effort between myself and our bass player, Carl Trabosky. So, you know, I gave that one over to Volume 2, and Volume 3 actually has a track of mine, which is just a four-track cassette demo that I knocked off one Friday afternoon at home. I think it was November of 1997, a song called Your Eyes, which in my mind, I wanted it to be a very Paul McCartney kind of track. I think I kind of McCartneyed it up on the bass line.
Yeah.
But it really is a very R.E.M. sounding track. Either way, I actually like this song. It's a neat little pop song. It's definitely one of those that once it gets in your head, you're going to hum it, which is the sign of any good pop song. And I don't think that's me blowing my own horn. It's just a case of, okay, I hit the jackpot on this one.
Excellent. And,
you know, DW certainly cleaned it up for the sake of sonic quality, because, again, a four-track cassette demo is not always going to do you proud.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that was my contribution, and it's gotten some incredibly warm reactions, which I'm very thankful for and appreciative of. But there are other really great people on there. Like, I don't want to play favorites, but the one I keep listening to the most is Lisa Michaels.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she's got a track record as a wonderful pop singer songwriter, you know, power popist. And the whole beauty of this project is DW has given an avenue to so many musicians, and it's not about money, it's about exposure, and exposing these incredible talents to anybody who's just smart and astute enough to take the time and patience to listen. So that's why I wanted to give this more of a flagging than I think we've given it before, because it's out there, and it's not just the third volume. There's number two and there's number one. So if you take the time, just look it up. It's the Co-op Communique, and you'll find it. You know, DW's own work is on there. It's just a lot of fun to listen to because it is so wonderfully diverse and mixed.
Well, if I can ever get off my ass and finish a song, maybe we can both be on volume four.
That makes two of us, especially because I have yet to record anything with this incredible 32-track digital recording unit of mine, which was the dream, and I've yet to plug it in because I'm an asshole. strike that, I'm a lazy asshole.
Yep.
You know, I might have some new material, but for number four, there will be another one of my four-track demos, complete with bungles on the guitar solo, because it's a demo, you know, it's not going to be perfect.
Right.
You got a structure together, boom, there's your demo.
You know, I want to stop and go off into a little bit of a tangent now, because you said something that tripped something off in my head. There's been so much vault material from great bands that has been undiscovered, you know, forever. The Beatles kind of kicked that off with the releases in the mid-90s. And since then, everybody's got their vault stuff that keeps coming out. And sometimes it really is a sort of a garage discovery. Somebody trips over a trunk that's got a whole bunch of tape in it. And sometimes it's a little more contrived than that. But now, because of the advent of digital recording, I wonder if those days are over, because almost always when there's a big new release of something, all of the attendant material is starting to come out with it. So if it's music that's coming out today, I wonder if the days of those kinds of vault finds are over now, because the material is certainly going to be there, and it's going to last a lot longer because, as you said, nobody's taping over anything. There's no tape anymore. There's no reason to do it. But if the material is all coming out as the release comes out, then I think it's going to take some of that fun away.
I think ours is probably, I don't want to get too philosophical about it, but I think ours is probably the last generation that will have done this, or certainly gone to such care and pains to try and save, preserve, and then transfer from the analog tapes into digital these vault tapes for posterity.
Yeah.
Before they start to disintegrate. I mean, you know the story of Richard Barone's Cool Blue Halo, the original, and subsequently also the Bongo's Phantom Train. Both of those were recorded on tape in the 80s that were supposed to basically self-destruct because they were supposed to be environmentally friendly. So the pain of, if they hadn't come up with the theory that actually worked for them, putting them in convection ovens and baking them for 12 hours
right.
to store the material that was on the tape, those would be gone forever. We would never be able to hear a remixed, you know, certainly bolstered Cool Blue Halo, and we would have never finally gotten Phantom Train. So you have something like that in hand. You know, cassette tapes disintegrate like there's nothing to it. I'm almost afraid to, even though I still have a working cassette deck, afraid to play any of my cassettes because at this point they're all over 20 years old.
Yeah.
And a couple have gone into pieces where it just slows down, stops, and all of a sudden I pull it out and stuff is just coming off of it. Cassette was not a great medium. It was certainly handy and economically sound for doing demos, especially when you're learning.
Right.
But you know, also when you've got a band and you've – the most important thing is when you've exhausted every possible thing that could be in the vaults by then, chances are you're going to start to run afoul of the notion of, okay, nobody really wants to hear this. So you're not going to sell anything. So there's not going to be any interest in any further releases of that kind of thing. I mean, certainly with me releasing something to the co-op communique with, you know, a mistake on the guitar solo, it's a demo. You know, what do you expect from a home demo? This wasn't released later on in another version or something. It was just a song that I had and always kind of kept in pocket for the punchline should we have ever gotten back together. And I was going to produce a version of it for what would have been our second album. It didn't happen, but okay, you know. I don't know that I'd want to hear everything that has still not been released by the Beatles because I'm sure that some of it is just absolute shit.
Sure.
Some of it I'd like to hear in a... certainly in a better mixed version because I've heard bootlegs that just don't sound clear enough to really get it.
Yep.
Even though it's just a history lesson's sake. But you bring up such a good point. We could go on and on.
Well, the one good news about it is that it's going to save us from the Justin Bieber From the Vault album. So
I am more than sure there will never come a day where he will be one of those who will have an anthology because none of these people in these last 20 years. And there have been some songs by artists here and there that, yeah, I have liked because the song is just catchy, but no one in the last 20 years has been worth remembering.
No, true. And you look at even the fact that their own fans don't talk about the old music the way you and I talk about our favorite bands now and the stuff that they did 20 years ago. If a song is a year old, it's forgotten. And if you don't keep producing new stuff all the time, you get forgotten in the pop world. And there's always been some of that, but, you know, you and I still remember one-hit wonders from 1973.
Right. But the thing is also, that's because the songs themselves were memorable.
Right.
One thing I have to say, and it's interesting because this was part of a conversation I was having this morning with my wife, is you don't care about what you hear nowadays. She was talking about Nicki Minaj and asked me if I'd ever heard anything by her. And the truth is I've never heard a song. I've heard of her. I've seen her.
Yeah, it's like, and I don't know. Maybe.
I don't know and could not tell you. And I said, in all honesty, the last new top 40 pop single that I can actively remember, because when I heard it, I thought this is a really good song and it's catchy, was Since You've Been Gone by Kelly Clarkson.
Yeah.
That's how old now?
Right, 10 years. And you know, you put it in that perspective and you think, okay, in order for something to have value, there has to be a rarity to the commodity. And part of it is the fact that radio has gone. You know, music radio has died a slow and painful death. And so those gatekeepers aren't there anymore. Everybody can get everything out on the net. And that's great in one way for smaller artists who have a way to make a name without a record label behind them. But it also means that there's so bloody much out there that there is no rarity at all to songs. There's millions of them. And because of that, there's no reason for any of them to stand out or be memorable.
Well, one, there's a couple of points that you bring up, and every one of them are absolutely 100% accurate. One, there's nothing really that memorable about any of these songs. I mean, I couldn't tell you for 1 second what's on the charts right now.
Yeah.
Not one. That's, and I think that's part of it. And I'm involved deeply in music, too. Were it not for Popdose, truly, I would not have heard of half of the things that I've heard of in these last few years.
Right.
That I've wound up, that you and I actually wound up completely smitten with, because frankly, I wouldn't be paying attention. You know, what passes itself off for new music in this day and age is an absurdity. First of all, it's all a physical fashion.
Yep.
You know, I think with the advent of mall punk, as personified by Green Day in their Stiff Little Fingers Clash wannabe style, you know, that to me was the final nail in the coffin. You know, I always bristle when I hear, you know, 1991, the year that punk broke. Go fuck yourself. No, 1991 was not the year that punk broke, because there's nothing punk about Nirvana, okay?
Right.
And I'm really tired of that topic, and I am tired of the lauding of a nihilistic heroin addict as being some kind of savior or arbiter of all that became good taste and artistic value. Please, all Nirvana were catchy in places. Heavy band. There are a lot of catchy heavy bands. Ever hear of Thin Lizzy?
Right, right.
Ever hear of Free?
It had all been done before.
But you and I remember these songs from 1973 or 74, and we could probably name who at least performed it, is because those songs were poured over by writers who knew how to reach a certain audience. If the song became bigger than they expected, which was usually the case,
yep,
all the more better, because that means it gets itself a place in people's memories for all time. I mean, look, the last time I actively sought out a new band, and I'm using the term new in quotation marks, was, and I'm probably going to fumble the year because I'm just not certain. The last 10 years are always a little murky for me, but the last new band I went out of my way to look into once I heard their first American single was the Kaiser Chiefs. And they've never made it over here, save for the fact that for whatever reason, sports arenas tend to play, I predict, a riot.
Yeah.
But, you know, this was the last band that I actively sought out, in the same way that I would look for bands like Blur, you know, or going back before that, well, everything, you know, from REM to the Hooskers to the Minutemen, you know, and the American Underground and the DBs and everybody else that came in that ilk. And prior to that, the British punk bands, from the Jam to the Teardrop Explodes and the Stranglers. You know, there is nothing right now that you and I can lay claim that will have any meaning or even be referred back to in another 5 to 10 years' time.
Right. And see, the example that I always go back to is, I think it was 1993 or 94, when all of a sudden, I mean, the Beatles vault stuff had not quite come out yet, I don't think. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, came this buzz about a Led Zeppelin song that they had found after all these years, and nobody ever knew that they recorded it, and it was this big, you know, what's it going to sound like? And I had a great deal of trepidation going into that, because I was thinking, if this is another one of these avant-garde, you know, Presence-era pieces of junk, then I'm going to hate it. I don't even like going down this road. And then Traveling Riverside Blues came out, and holy shit, it was great. I mean, it was just absolutely brilliant. And I thought, you know, that's the kind of thing that's not going to happen again. There will never be, 12 years after a band breaks up, a song that comes out that blows everybody away.
So in other words, you're not a fan of Nobody's Fault But Mine or Achilles' Last Stand.
Nobody's Fault But Mine's all right, yeah.
Now, you take that right into 1995, when, you know, there was that, and I can, this is one of those I can actually remember. I was working in Williamsburg at the time and driving to work, and I was in traffic, and it was on, of all things, WCBS FM 101.1 in New York, which is the oldies FM station, when they announced, we are about to premiere the new single from the Beatles.
Right.
Now, you're sitting there and you're thinking to yourself only one thing. I know this is going to be the Beatles, because we all know what this is supposed to be, what it sounds like. Okay, we'll know in a moment. But did I ever expect in my lifetime, my conscious lifetime, because I was 5 when the Beatles split up, but did I ever think I would hear a brand new Beatles single? Even if Lennon hadn't died, you know, did I ever think I'd hear a brand new Beatles single?
Right.
And Truth be told, on initial listen, my first thought was, ugh. And I say that because of the Jeff Lynne production. He did exactly what I feared he would do. When I heard that Jeff Lynne produced it, I was so angry. I thought, no, 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 no. George Martin is alive and well. He has to produce this. He has to put this together. He has to mix this. Not Jeff Lynne. He's going to do what he always does. And sure enough, he did what he always does with that highly compressed drum sound that's the Jeff Lynne trademark. And it drove me absolutely bonkers.
Right.
The song itself turned out to be better than I expected, simply because, and you can say what you will about me and my personality and that I always give the nod to Paul McCartney, but it was McCartney who shaped the skeleton of the song that Lennon had and made it into a complete piece because of the way that Free as a Bird comes out and comes along.
Right.
You have Lennon, McCartney, Lennon, Harrison, and then, you know, the harmonies. And of course, hearing the ahs in the background irked me because you can hear Jeff Lynne's voice in there. And it was just really his fulfillment of wanting to be a Beatle-type fantasy. I mean, yeah. The truth is, I think Real Love is a much better song when you get down to it. But Free as a Bird had never been heard before, whereas Real Love was heard in its original demo form at the end of Imagine. Nevertheless, that opened the floodgates because Anthology 1 came out.
Right.
And then all of a sudden Anthology 2 came out, and then a year after. So you had basically the Beatles on the charts from, you know, 95, 96, and 97,
yeah.
Which was a wonderful thing because where did all those records go? They all went to the top of the charts. And ironically enough, when Beatles 1, remember when Beatles 1 came out?
Mm-hmm.
And that was at the top of the album charts, the Billboard 200, for how many weeks? It proved once again my theory that, sorry kids, your Pearl Jams and your Nirvanas and your Alice in Chains and all that stuff is never going to have the lasting power that the Beatles will have, because
right.
The Beatles have been gone for now at this point 37 years, and a collection of their singles manages to get to the top of the charts and stay there. What we're dealing with now musically, well, hopefully I'll be dead in another 10 or 20 years. I don't have to listen to this fucking stuff ever make a comeback. Listen, no one's ever going to remember. And the fact that the Backstreet Boys are having their, I think, 20th or 25th anniversary.
Oh,
my God. There you go. I Want It That Way is a good song. That's a catchy, memorable song.
Right.
Can't argue with that. That's a good song. I don't mean you. I mean, I can't argue with that. It's a good song. But come on. Anything else? No. Listen, Robbie Williams may have been part of a boy band, but he never made it over here.
Yep.
First three albums. And I saw him live, and I really had a lot of hope because I thought he was putting out the records Oasis should have been.
Right.
But, you know, he never made it over here. So that's over and done.
We'll get back to music in a minute. But before we do, I wanted to sort of pat ourselves and by virtue of that, popped us on the back for something. Because in our last get together, actually a couple of weeks ago, we talked about the song B.A.B.Y. because it was in the Soul Serenade column that Ken Chain puts together. And as it so happens, that song ended up playing a prominent role in the movie Baby Driver, which is, have you seen it yet? Did you get to...
I have not. I haven't been to the movies. Every time I say I'm going to go see Wonder Woman, I find another excuse.
Well, we did. We got to go see Baby Driver last weekend, and it's we were hearing great. This movie it's a great heist film. It's a really good heist film. I would step one back from putting it in the same category with like the original Italian Job or something like that. It's not there, but it's a fun movie to watch, and the fact that one of the main sort of drivers of the movie, pardon the pun, is the fact that a lot of the action takes place rhythmically timed to the music that's playing on the soundtrack, which is kind of a neat device. Gunshots happen on drum beats, that sort of thing. And it gives it a sort of music video quality to it, but it also pays a lot of homage to other movies, to music, to even literary references that show up in the movie, which is also kind of a cool thing, but that song, B.A.B.Y., was there on the soundtrack, and it featured prominently in one of the main pieces of action. I just thought that was cool, a nice little bit of timing that it ended up in Ken Chain's column, and then all of a sudden there it is on the screen, too.
let's just say we're forward thinkers.
That's right.
I think that's the best way of describing it.
Which is another way of saying we fucking rule is what it comes down to. So,
okay, that's fine. I mean, usually I'm the one for known for his braggadocio, but by all means, you are correct. Now maybe hopefully there will be this big upsurge of the Beau Brummels, you know, with the way everybody's been falling all over Pet Sounds and this and that, you know. I'd like to see a little love for the Brummels or for the Lovin' Spoonful, but hey, that's just my bag.
No doubt. No doubt about it. And as we get back into the music thing, that's kind of a nice way about it, because you and I had both been watching Sun Records, and it had its ups and downs, certainly, but it was a lot of fun to go through. And the guys that play the Million Dollar Quartet in Sun Records are now part of an actual record, which proves, I guess, that these guys can at least sing well enough to get on a compilation record. But it's the record itself that's the real news here. Memphis is once again featured prominently. What's going on?
Do I come off as unidimensional?
Not at all.
Obsessive, you know? I mean, okay, granted, the fact that I actually had to cancel my vacation to Memphis this year, unfortunately. You know, I my heart is in that town. I basically went there and never came back. I'm just physically here, you know?
Yep.
Mentally, forget it. I'm there right now. Well, there's this wonderful compilation that has come out. It is called Red Hot, a Memphis celebration of Sun Records. It is a tribute to songs that were recorded during the original golden era of Sun and its sister studio, Sam C. Phillips Recording, which is still in business, actually, for, I think, full-time recording. But nevertheless, this album has people like Luther Dickinson, of course, and his brother Cody, who are, of course, guitar and drums from the North Mississippi All-Stars. Amy LaVere, who is a very well-known Memphis-based bass player. Rick Steff, who is a Memphis legend on keyboards. He played with Chris Bell and, you know, Van Doren and everybody we know and love from Memphis. The band Lucero, plus other great people like Jimbo Mathis. And if you don't know who Jimbo Mathis is, generally speaking, you're a fucking idiot, not you. Because first and foremost, he was with, God help me, he was one of the Squirrel Nut Zippers.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yes, as in the D and the A and the M and the N and the E and the D and the A O N, you know, just all that.
Nouveau Swing.
Yeah, thankfully he salvaged himself from that, because he's such an amazing musician, guitarist, producer, talent, all around good guy. Works with our buddy Eric Roscoe Amble and a whole host of other people, and he is just an incredible musician. So they're all on here, and this record has got some really outstanding individual tracks, like Jimbo's version of Jerry Lee Lewis's High School Confidential, which is the song that was, I think that was the one that was touted as being the big one for him when he fell from grace.
Yeah, we rocking at the high school high, and we strolling at the high school high. We're moving at the high school high, heroin at the high school high. I seen everybody sobbing, everybody sobbing, rocking at the high school high. Let's go!
That was on the chart going up, and that's when the shit hit the fan.
Right.
But then there's this really beautiful version by a singer named Valerie June, whose name I've heard over the years. I still can't quite remember because my memory fails me terribly. But she did an amazing version of the Carl Perkins song, Sure to Fall, which it's far sweeter than the Beatles BBC Sessions version, which, if you remember, that was just not as good as it was touted to be. But then, yes, the cast of Sun Records actually does, of course, the classic song Red Hot, you know. My gal is red hot, your gal ain't doodly squat.
Yeah.
You know, so you've got this great spectrum's worth of songs from the Sun Records catalog. It's not people covering, you know, That's All Right Mama or Mystery Train or any of that. They're not sticking with the Elvis Presley thing. It's songs that were recorded at Sun, not necessarily on the Sun label imprint, but like, you know, Howlin' Wolf's Moanin' at Midnight, which is done to death here by Luther Dickinson. That wasn't a Sun release, but it was recorded at Sun by Sam Phillips. This is an amazing collection, but also this album was done not only is a labor of love, but this is a charity record. And that's the most important thing about it. The American Music Society is donating all the proceeds from this compilation to help benefit the St. Jude's Children's Hospital, which, if you don't know the St. Jude's Children's Hospital, it is the world's leading center for helping children, usually with life-threatening illnesses like children's cancer, et cetera, et cetera. It is located in Memphis.
Right. And so, that was Danny Thomas and now, by extension, Marlo Thomas. They're the ones who have been, over the years, really the driving force behind raising money for St. Jude's.
And this is one of those charities that I will certainly get behind and talk about, as I always have, because it's worth its while. And so it's a 1-2 punch here. You know, you're doing – if you buy this record – you're knowing that the money's in good hands, that it's going to a worthwhile cause, and the music you're getting is such a part of America. It's part of our history and lineage. And if you're like me, you hold that very near and dear. That it was recorded in Memphis as part of a Memphis-based compilation, of course, that makes me feel warmer. But the point is, there's a meaning, a greater meaning behind this than just paying tribute to a studio and a record label.
Yeah, and it's also great music on top of it, like you said. So definitely want to get a hold of this one. And, you know, it's what's nice about this is that not only are they donating the proceeds to St. Jude's, but they're also going way out of their way to promote this record. I have seen more advertisements online over the last couple of weeks for this record than I think I have for any other record release in the last couple of years.
Well, then somebody's doing an even better job than I could have ever hoped or imagined, to see physical ads online for a charity release and a historic release. My hope is that come next year it might win an Americana Award.
Would
and
love
certainly
to see
it. Place in Oxford, in the Oxford American, you know, because I haven't seen anything yet, at least not, again, in recent memory. But who knows? Perhaps it'll be in another edition.
Yeah, and it's a Red Hot of Memphis Celebration of Sun Records. So definitely want to check that one out if you don't have a copy of it already. And a few things going on outside the music world to take a look at. I'm interested to find out a little bit more about this because over the last couple of weeks across the country, we had Pride Fests. And there was one here and there was one near you. And curiously, there have been some sort of skidding off the rails kind of things that that went on.
You're very diplomatic.
Yeah, well, I try. Well, and the one here in St. Louis, I don't know how much national play this got, but during the Pride Parade, there was a float that won. I guess they had judging going on, and the float that won the Pride Parade was summarily stripped of its title. Right after it was noted that on board this float, in addition to all of the rainbow flags and everything else, was a Blue Lives Matter flag. And this is the group of police officers and others who are kind of a backlash to the Black Lives Matter movement, saying, hey, what about us cops too? Well, as it turns out, the St. Louis Pride organization was supportive of Black Lives Matter. So when they saw the Blue Lives Matter flag, they took their trophy away. And it just got to be so incredibly stupid that this ruckus came up over a float in a parade that's a pride parade on top of everything. But, you know, as a sidebar to that, it also shows that everybody wants to insert every political stance that they take into everything that they do. And, you know, I should they have had their trophy taken away? Oh, who gives a shit? But it is kind of like showing up at an anti-war rally and screaming about abortion. It's just, you know, one thing doesn't equate to the other. Why does everything have to be so intensely political that you have to show everything, wear everything on your sleeve at all times, and if anybody argues with you, it turns into some stupid fight like this?
Well, you're leading me right into what I was about to say, and you've done it perfectly, because one, this is the community that I guarantee you will eat itself up faster than anyone else will, because now you're seeing all the warring factions start to rear their ugly little heads.
Yep.
I have a newsflash for everybody, especially the gay community. You aren't special. There you go.
Yep.
I know it's maybe shocking to you, but you're not special. I don't look at you any differently than I look at anybody else that I know. If I know you and I like you as a person, I don't care that you're gay. Are you an asshole? If you've got the wrong political motivation, you better believe it.
Sure.
You know, or the wrong social skills, or whatever it is. I don't care what your sexual preference is. First of all, I still haven't gotten the idea of why we have to go through all this falderal anyway. But that's another conversation entirely. But you had this little bit of nonsense going on in St. Louis. I believe this happened in Chicago or in the suburbs of Chicago, but it was somewhere in Illinois. It was during, I guess it was Pride Saturday or Pride Sunday, when every city had its Pride parades. And there is this group of Jewish lesbian bikers.
Wait, that was a Monty Python routine, wasn't it?
I think so. You know, a Jew, a lesbian, and a biker all go into a bar. Right. Something like this, because the story never came out crystal clear. The short and clearest version I can deliver to you is this, because it's about what happened. This group of Jewish lesbians were going to march in the parade. They had the rainbow flag, which that became a cause of controversy in and of itself.
Yep.
Again, why this community will eat itself up, you be the judge. They had the Star of David on the flag. This group of lesbian bikers said, "We don't want you in our parade or in our whatever the fuck it was they were doing."
Yeah.
Because we don't support Israel. We are pro-Palestine.
Oh, come on.
I'm serious as a heart attack.
Yeah.
As a member... Oh, who am I kidding? As a Jew, I found that to be almost laughable were it not for the sheer ignorance. Now, here's why this community is going to eat itself up. Okay. I have made it clearly stated time and time again, you think for one second, the Palestinian terrorists that are over there, let alone anywhere else, the Palestinian terrorists are going to find their hearts overflowing with pride and gratitude.
Yeah, right.
For a bunch of women, first of all, women, just women, taking such a moral, noble stand for them. No. Do you think for one second that they would find themselves, you know, their hearts filling with pride and appreciation for the fact that a bunch of lesbians were going to the plate to bat for them? No.
No.
Why don't you all go over there and see how quickly they either throw you from a rooftop or decapitate you?
Yeah.
You people, and yeah, I'm saying that phrase, you people, I'm singling you out for showing your absolute fucking ignorance. And whatever shitty things may happen to you in the end, because karma always wins, I hope you reap it tenfold. Because you claim to be so all-inclusive, go fuck yourself.
Right up until somebody disagrees with you. And then you got to take their little trophies away and do anything you can. And, you know, what it does in my mind is it takes away from the fact that there are still problems. I mean... Wyoming wasn't that long ago. You know, great, it was 20 years ago, but still, things like that still happen. People still get beaten up and you know, kicked around because of who they fall in love with and who they sleep with. And that's insufferable and horrible. But do we really need to take it to the point? I mean, do we need to make an issue out of the fact that somebody's got a Star of David on their flag or somebody's got this flag or that flag? No. How about, you know, making the issue what it has always been, which is everybody has the right to be with whoever they want to and don't fuck with anybody. It's just simple.
Maybe we're fortunate in the fact that we're just naturally normal human beings. Because if we use phrases for ourselves to describe ourselves as being whether or not we were progressive or forward thinking or we just don't see things this way, okay? You know, we're just normal human beings. I see you for who you are. If you're a dick to me, I'm going to dislike you.
Right.
If you're nice to me, I'm going to like you.
Yeah.
It's that simple. I don't give a shit who you fuck, who you vote for.
What color you are, any of that crap. Yeah.
As long as you fucking worship the Beatles, Big Star, and The Who, you're okay with obviously.
Yeah.
You gotta, don't come to me with any other horseshit. Don't you dare come to me with that argument about the Rolling Stones are better than the Beatles. I'll kick you in the ass.
That's right.
But, you know, this kind of shit, intra-communal fighting is what kills movements fastest. And I do hope this kind of thing starts to really eat at these groups from within, because then maybe they'll stop and have a moment of clarity. It's like all the fighting over the flag. A fucking flag, John.
Right.
Because they added, what was it, brown and something else to make it more inclusive? Why brown? For the Bears? What, you know, yeah, I know what Bears are. I'm from New York, goddammit.
Right.
Jesus H fucking Christ. What is wrong with these people?
Well,
what happened this year in the gay community that made everybody suddenly become stupid?
Right. And on that subject, and kind of a little sidebar to it, there is, at the same time as we're all pulling our hair out and going, why is everybody acting like a snitty little child? And that goes from the office of the president all the way down to the people who organize floats for parades. Out steps a guy, and I'm proud to say that he's been a Facebook friend of mine for a long time, and I'm proud to have him as a listener to my show as well. A guy by the name of Cedric Hendricks, and I'm calling him out by first and last name because he took himself out of the shadows over the course of this week and wrote an editorial piece for the small newspaper in the St. Louis area that caters mostly to the African-American community. It's called the St. Louis American. And Cedric Hendricks wrote an opinion piece for them about how it is to be who he is. And who he is an African-American police officer in the city of St. Louis. And the article is called Too Black for the Badge, Too Blue for the Brothers. And it talks about what the struggle really is when you have... when you don't really feel, you're not allowed to feel a complete part of either one of those communities because they're always suspicious of you. The cops are suspicious of you that you're black first and a cop second. And the brothers, as he calls them, are always suspicious that you're a cop first and black second. So nobody really trusts you, but both sides want to hold you to task for what the other side does. And they come to you and say, explain yourself, explain these other cops, or explain these black people to us. And it's a fascinating piece. Read it. It's online at stlamerican.com. And you'll get a real feel for the fact that, yes, there are still sane people out there who can call out the bullshit when anybody does it and who don't automatically think, as you were getting to, Rob, the idea that, well, if you conform to this group that I support, then I have to like you. Nope, not if you're an asshole, I don't. So, yeah, we're not the only ones. There are still some really bright people out there, but read that article.
I will. You know, it's funny because it kind of reminds me, in a very low-key way, of this gentleman I used to always see on the ferry ride home years ago. He was an older man. He was an older black man really shouldn't matter, but I guess in the framework of the conversation. And I noticed one day that he actually was wearing a yarmulke.
Okay, yeah.
You know, he actually had it clipped to his hair. And one particular Friday on the way home, I saw him again, and he was reading. I thought it looked like your standard Bible, but he was actually reading the Old Testament in Hebrew. And I just walked past him, and I smiled at him, and I actually just said to him, and I wasn't being funny, I just said to him, good yontif. And he looked at me, and he said something about, you know, have a wonderful Shabbos. He knew exactly what. So the thing is that to me, it's not that he's a black man. He's just, he happens to be a fellow Jew in a neighborhood where, because he was on the ferry, and let's face it, there aren't a lot of us. I mean, I don't wear a yarmulke, and I don't go to temple, but, you know, it's nice to see someone with a sense of religiosity of, you know.
Right.
Except for the Hasids, because that's just another story entirely. But I mean, here's a local guy, and I'm sure he's looked upon in his anomaly because, you know, he's black and he's Jewish. You know what? Who gives a shit? At the end of the day, we're all the same people, especially if we're of the same religious background. Then we've got – and let's face it, the chosen people, we get the shit kicked out of us no matter what.
Yeah.
So I got a pretty heavy-duty, you know, keister. You can kick me. It's not going to knock me down, you know. But nevertheless, I don't want to get off on a tangent. The whole thing with this gay pride thing really put, for me, a very large nail in a coffin in my view of that community, because they were the ones who held themselves up, certainly to be paragons of virtue, because of, you know, their struggle and what they've gone through. And you know what? They've showed themselves to be the pettiest of all. So with that kind of contempt that I now have mixed with the disappointment, you're not going to see me, you know, raising my hands to be so defensive of them anymore. You know, we've all got our own problems. Sort yourself out.
Yeah.
You know,
right. You're right.
with the police, you know, if you're going to go out there and you're going to start talking about, you know, how much you're a champion of Sarsour, go fuck yourself. And by the way, a complete aside, because you brought up the infantility of people everywhere, including our president, it has to be said, the mayor of New York City, there was I don't know if it made the news out in St. Louis, but a New York City police officer was assassinated this week. She was shot at point blank range, sitting in her vehicle with a partner, by a man with a gun who then ran down the street and wound up being shot by other police officers. The trains in New York have been beyond the word horrific because of problems that are being had on the lines that lead into Penn Station, which if you know Penn Station, of course, you know that that is the means into New York by rail, by New Jersey Transit, by Amtrak, the Long Island Railroad.
Yep.
The mayor of New York, and this week in particular, was incredibly hellish, and they're going to start working on these lines, which make things worse. The mayor of New York City found it in his heart and in his soul to go to Germany to join the protesters in Hamburg and to deliver a speech.
Right.
Rather than be here in New York, where I'm sorry, but, and I am a Democrat, and everybody knows this, but this man who is a Democratic mayor has been the most inefficient and unsupportive when it comes to the police. I mean, he's basically thumbed his nose and shown a contempt for police that I don't recall any other previous administration having done. And I find it appalling that he takes the time to go to Germany because Donald Trump is there.
Yeah.
Rather than doing his job, especially in light of the murder of a police officer.
Right.
And I'm absolutely disgusted. And today's New York Post headline reads Deutschbag. I think that as much of a rag as the New York Post is, I think that is an absolutely perfect way to describe the unfolding of this week's events. And I'm sorry, the man is up for re-election, but there is I would sooner vote for a bag of dog shit on fire than vote for that man again. I voted for him the last time, and from the moment he came out of the gate, he's been a shit mayor, and he's just getting worse. And I pray that the city comes to its senses.
Right. Well, and given Donald Trump, I think a bag of dog shit on fire isn't necessarily out of the realm of possibility for the Republicans to run against Bill de Blasio. So you may get your wish. But on that subject, we get into what's been going on in Germany, and the president's now back. And after the speech that he gave in Poland, was criticized for that. And after the Vlad, did you screw with our elections? No.
Oh, no.
Oh, okay. Good enough for me. Bye, everybody. I mean, it's just, it continues to be just a complete embarrassment around the world and here at home. It's just, it's so unfathomable. And yet, the press keeps getting distracted by minutiae. And nobody really knows what to make out of this or do about it, which is the worst part.
I have no answers anymore.
Yeah.
I really don't. It's because it becomes what you and I have talked about and feared, that we're going over the same ground over and over again, because there is no answer to this. The fact that I'm in agreement with Lindsey Graham's view of Donald Trump speaks volumes, but nobody can seemingly do anything about it.
Right.
Lindsey Graham is one person. You need more people in that Congress, in that Senate, to do something about this.
Mm-hmm.
He's made us, and this is what angers me so much, and you know how I feel about this, that we look so idiotic in the eyes of the world just by virtue of who our president is.
Right.
Not us as a people, but because he represents us. And that just sets my teeth on edge.
Yeah, and we have the worst possible choice for Speaker of the House. I mean, where is Paul Ryan with all of this? And the fact that every time Donald Trump does another stupid thing, Paul Ryan steps up and says, oh, that was really bad and that was really terrible. He shouldn't talk that way. He shouldn't do those kinds of things. He shouldn't have said that in his tweet. What are you going to do about it, Paul Ryan? Nothing.
Well, the same can be said about that other fuckhead, Mitch McConnell.
Yep.
I mean, talk about a useless piece of shit criminal himself, but it's gotten to that degree, and now we're only 7 months in, and I'm exhausted from it. I have to tell you, my wife and I were talking about this a couple of days ago, and the fact that we don't talk about politics like we used to is because we're just so tired from it. it leaves you completely weary. The whole thing last week with Morning Joe was, I think, the final kicker, because I won't even turn it on in the morning anymore.
Right.
I just leave on the local cable news, you know, just so I know what weather, basic headlines, you know, and local news. And that's it.
Yeah, well, it's the good news about that is it's time for us to get away from all of it and just go to our final segment, which is called In Our Heads. And every week here on the show, we end up talking a little bit about something that has been in our heads all week. And I figured we'd take a little bit of a different turn. And this will either go really well or it will crash and burn. We'll see. But I had you, Rob, pull out your iPod. And I've got, I usually play my music on the Amazon app on my phone. So I've got mine all ready to go and it's already on shuffle on my playlist. So what I want you to do eventually is put yours on shuffle and just tell me a story about the next song that it plays. I don't even know what mine's on the Immigrant Song, but just to hit the next one in shuffle. Let's see what pops up, and I'll see if I can find something interesting to say about why it's there on my playlist in the first place. And it picks... Ah, I'm really happy about this. So mine picked out Papa Jean's Blues by the Monkees. And this one, of all of the songs that it could have picked, I think... Now, this one is an alternate mix, and I'm not sure exactly what that means. I'd have to listen to it. But just the, you know, that song alone, was that one of the ones that was written by them? Do you remember?
It's a Michael Nesmith track.
Is it a Michael Nesmith track? I had a feeling that it was. I knew he sang on it.
Written, produced, and sang by Michael Nesmith.
I have no more than I did before, but now I've got all that I need. For I love you and I know you love me. Play Magic Fingers.
In fact, Peter Tork actually plays acoustic guitar on it. That was one of the songs that were a controversy on the first album when they went in there expecting to record as performing musicians. And, you know, the beauty of that song, there's nothing wrong with that song. By the way, you know, if you've ever seen the very first pressing of the first Monkees album, it's actually spelled Papa Jean's, J-E-A-N-S, Blues,
yes.
Rather than Papa Jean is in the shortening of Eugene.
Right.
Papa Jean's Blues. I think that is the first time you hear the perfect interweaving of Mike and Mickey singing harmonies together. Just magnificent.
I was going to say the same thing. And that, you know, that song has such a great feel to it, and you get a real, it's almost a hearkening back to, well, like we were talking about before, the Million Dollar Quartet, the fact that rock and roll grew out of rockabilly, and that it has all of those elements to it. And yet you also see the fact that these guys really could sing, and that, you know, not only that, but they could really come up with a good lyric and a nice hook, and that it was all there, that there was real talent there, despite all of the shit that they took for being the prefab four.
All because they were honest too. Isn't that ironic?
Yeah.
You know, it was Nesmith who said, you know, no, we do not play on all our records, but nobody brings up the fact that Brian Wilson and the Beach Boys don't play on all their records. The Beatles don't play on all their records.
Right.
The Animals, and so on and so forth. You know, Dave Clark Five, their drummer was never Dave Clark except for live performances.
Uh-huh.
You know, so Michael Nesmith was just trying to be honest, and there was just, you know what? It's typical press. They always had their knives drawn and ready to find a scapegoat, and they made the Monkees a scapegoat because the Monkees were a success right from the moment Last Train to Clarksville hit the airwaves and the show went on TV. Listen, it was the right thing at the right time. You know, the Monkees were the perfect gateway for kids who were a little too small when the Beatles first landed. So now you're a little bit older, and suddenly the Monkees are there to fill in the gap left by the Beatles, who are at this point just getting weird.
Yeah, right. So Papa Jean's Blues is what mine picked out, so now it's your turn. If you've got your iPod on shuffle, go ahead and hit next and tell us what the song is.
The first track that my shuffle picked up was, surprisingly enough, Anna Go to Him, the old Arthur Alexander song, as done by the Beatles.
Anna,
Please Please Me, or as it was known to us, introducing the Beatles. And therein lies a story, because Yeah, when I was a child, obviously the first records I ever owned were Revolver, the first Monkees album, the Yellow Submarine Eleanor Rigby single, and Strawberry Fields Penny Lane singles. I started to really get, quote, into the Beatles probably when I was coming out of my Kiss phase. And I was in this, it was sort of like a local version of Woolworth's called Masters.
Okay.
We either had, you know, there were these periods when they had this outstanding record department of their own, you know, but then they would get rid of the record department and just have cutouts. You know, it was like every 3-4 years they would do this.
Right.
And this was one of the points when they had cutouts, and I found this album on VJ Records called Introducing the Beatles. And it was $2.99, and I thought, okay, you know what? This looks interesting. And, oh, it's got I Saw Her Standing There. Wait a minute. Isn't that on Meet the Beatles? Oh, look, it's got Love Me Do, you know, P.S. I Love You. Okay, I know these songs. What is this? A Taste of Honey, the old Herb Alpert song, you know. And I bought this record, and I played it, and I played it to death. I absolutely played it till it, you know, I won't play it anymore because it's got the white grooves worn into it. But it was the old VJ album that had been pulled off the market.
Yeah.
And on it was, I think this was actually the third track. What it is it is the Please Please Me album. You know, if you get this version of it, the one that I have with P.S. I Love You and Love Me Do, it is equal to the Please Please Me album, except it doesn't have Please Please Me or Ask Me Why on it. Both those songs were actually added later on. Long story short is that this album had, as its third track, after I Saw Her Standing There and Misery, which is a great song.
Yep.
Their version of Anna. So this is how I came to know the song. And I always actually liked it a lot. I liked Lennon's voice, even though, as we all know now, Lennon was sick with a really bad winter cold when they recorded this thing. You know, there's a life to it. There's a sparkiness to this song, considering it's a very sad song. You go back and you listen to Arthur Alexander's version, and it's kind of slow and mournful. The same way the Rolling Stones sparked life into You Better Move On.
You okay. know?
So did the Beatles with Anna. So remembering, you know, I was just all of, I don't know, 11 or 12 when I first heard this, and this was like the beginning of the conversion, you know? So, like, you know, it's not a stellar one of the numbers or covers that the Beatles had, but it's an early one and a good indication of what the Beatles could do as interpreters.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. And, you know, all the more reason to go back and give it a listen again. And what we want you to do, if you get the chance, is do the same thing. Hit shuffle on whatever it is you listen to music on and just put your next song in the comments section at the bottom of this page on PopDos. And we'll see if we can find some interesting ones to make note of next week. And in the meantime, Rob, anything coming up for next week we ought to let folks know we're going to be going over?
Yeah, a lot. Definitely things I want to plunder from the other good people at PopDos. But of course, I always like to keep it under wraps because, you know, if we give too much away, then people be sitting there looking and reading. No, I want us to surprise you. We like to deliver surprises. You know, we like to be unpredictable.
We will pull the veil back and we will finally, at long last, get to the new Roger Klein album as well. I know we've been promising that one for a few weeks as well. But next time around, we will definitely delve into that one as we've had the chance now to let it soak in and live with us for a little while. So have yourself a great week, Rob, and we'll look forward to talking to you again next time.
Well, as always, John, it is a pleasure and a joy, and have yourself a great week, brother.
You too, man. There is more, of course, on popdos.com. So go and check it all out. Read all of the articles and throw in as well. That's what the comments section is for. You can always find something new to listen to and some new video to watch as well. And we'll look forward to talking to you then.